You may proceed.
Thank you, Judge. Chief Justice, I thank you on behalf of Mr. Swallow and myself for giving me this chance to come before you and talk to you about what happened to him. The issue in this case is very simple. Did Mr. Swallow timely file for post-conviction relief on his first-degree assault conviction under Rule 24.035? So it seems to me that if we're talking about Rule 24.035, we should start by looking at the rule. When you look at the rule, as you know, it requires for a person to be able to file for relief under Rule 24.035, it requires two things.
He'd like his plea to be withdrawn so he could be possibly get life in prison in Missouri law.
That's his choice. He received a 20-year sentence, which is about midway in the range of punishment.
And then there's the 40 years in Kansas.
Yes. But, you know, that is his right in Missouri to file for post-conviction relief. It's not my role as his attorney to question his motives for doing so. If you look at Rule 24.035, it contains two requirements. First of all, it requires a guilty plea that results in a conviction. And the rule mentions the word conviction once, the word sentence 14 times, and the word judgment 13 times. Nowhere in that rule do we talk about guilty pleas, convictions, or sentences, which is why the state's position is, and the
why
court
would a guilty plea not result in a sentence?
An SIS, Judge. You could not file for post-conviction relief under Rule 24.035 if the court has imposed a suspended imposition of sentence.
But here it was an SES and there was a single judgment. Is that correct?
That was the basis that the Court of Appeals yes. decided on. I believe that's an incorrect understanding of the word judgment.
Okay.
Did Your Honor wish me to talk about that?
Please. That'd
okay.
be great.
If you look at the federal rules of, if you look at Black's Law Dictionary, which uses the federal rules of criminal procedure, it talks about a sentence. A judgment of conviction talks about a record of a sentence, not sentences. So I think the Court of Appeals confused the word judgment with the sentencing disposition. For instance,
don't we usually interpret judgment as the final adjudication of all the issues in one case? Isn't that what judgment means?
Not in the criminal context, Your Honor. If you look, this court in, excuse me.
Well, if there was a judgment that included both SESs and SISs, it's still a judgment, correct?
Well, if you look at the definition of the word judgment, I think it's somewhat confusing because the form we all use is called a sentence and judgment form. But if you notice, it doesn't say sentences and judgment form. It says sentence and judgment form. So even, you know, this court and the Court of Appeals say that a final judgment occurs only when a sentence is entered. It doesn't require there to be a final disposition of all the charges. For example, if Mr. Swallow had taken the case to trial instead of pleading guilty, and he had been convicted on one charge, but the jury had hung on the other, and the court had declared a mistrial, he could have proceeded to the Court of Appeals just on that one conviction. He wouldn't have had to wait around for a final disposition on that second charge that had hung. So, obviously, you know, the Court of Appeals, which requires a final judgment for purposes of appeal, does not require that all the sentences be disposed of before you can have a final judgment. Also, in the post-conviction context, if
could he have appealed the SESs at the time? I mean, SISs you can't because
right.
they're not a judgment and not a sentence.
But yes, he could have had a direct appeal in the SES. Yes.
Uh-huh. And so he could appeal everything at one time?
He could have, but he didn't have to.
Why do we have that choice?
Well, I'm saying in the context if the jury had hung and there had been a mistrial.
No, I'm not doing that. Say it's a guilty plea and there's four charges and he gets sentenced on two and the others he gets SESs.
Well,
can't he appeal them all because he's a judgment since it's an SES, not an SIS?
That's a hard question to answer because there are so few issues on direct appeals after guilty pleas.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we get appeals of all SESs all the time. I mean, people get SES and appeal.
Say it's a trial and there are three counts and the judge suspends imposition of sentence on one to leave a hammer.
No, there's no judgment, so yeah. There cannot be a direct appeal.
What about the other two counts where the judge sentenced him?
That could be a direct appeal. So there you go. You're gonna have two different tracks of cases because the one set he can appeal on the SESs, but he can't appeal on the SISs.
But my point is, I mean, I understand your argument, but the result of it would be he can appeal and say we just do that suspended execution of sentences on everything. He could appeal that immediately, or you're saying he could wait and then if he violated probation, then wait and appeal them later, and it's his option? I mean, we don't normally have that. There's a time when you have to appeal. You don't get multiple times to choose from.
I think it would be, and I've never run into that situation, so I don't know the precise answer, but I think the defendant would have to choose between one or the other.
Sure.
He couldn't, absolutely. You know, come back and say, well, I've decided I now want to appeal because I've already had my appeal. No, that's not possible. The other difficulty that we run into with Rule 24.035 is it has that additional requirement of delivery, which is the big issue here for Mr. Swallow, because he was not delivered to the Department of Corrections on the first-degree assault charge, a conviction, until after the court revoked his probation, which is after he had already completed the sentence on the armed criminal action in DOC. And if he had, for instance...
And opposing counsel raises an argument which, since the ACA depended on the underlying felony charge, and he'd already served his armed criminal action time, and then you're saying later on you can then challenge the underlying felony, does that make sense?
Well, that Mr. Swallow didn't have. I don't want to argue on the philosophy of armed criminal action because I feel it's an added punishment. So Your Honor does not want me to go there, It was not his choice. I mean, he received the sentencing disposition he received. The court was required, you know, by law, the court had to give him penitentiary time on the armed criminal action count. Probation was not an option. I'm sure Mr. Swallow would have preferred receiving probation on both charges, but it just was not legally possible.
I'm more addressing certainly not his choice of what to appeal or where to go, but in trying to figure out what the rule means and what he had to appeal at what time, looking at a logical way to interpret the statutes altogether and the appeal process altogether.
Well, if you look logically at Rule 24.035, if he would not have been able, if he had asked for post-conviction relief the first time he went to DOC to serve the armed criminal action count, if he had requested post-conviction relief back then, he probably would have been, it would have been dismissed as premature on the first degree assault case because he had not been delivered to DOC on that sentence.
So he would have had the right to fully pursue post-conviction relief on the armed criminal action and then again
we
fully
can
pursue our post-conviction relief. Again,
I think because of the way the court sentenced him, he under Rule 24.035, he would have been obliged to do it that way.
But I understand your argument about delivery, and he was only delivered on one and not mm-hmm. the other, and that
yes.
is a logical reading. But if you follow that, it leads to these anomalies. So does it make, looking at the overall picture, does it make sense that that's what would have been intended?
I suppose the answer to that is. Remove the mandatory prison time on armed criminal action. Don't have this problem. And also, this kind of sentencing disposition occurs very rarely. You don't see it very often. And I must tell the court that I am seeing it more than I used to. So, I mean, it may be an issue again in the future. But I think it's the court's way of trying to give probation where it can, you know, to give the defendant something of a break, but acknowledging that under the armed criminal action rule, he has to give the mandatory prison time.
Can you discuss the West Berger case?
The state distinguishes
that.
Thank you. Not being applicable here.
Westbecker
is the only case that I could find that was factually similar to what happened to Mr. Swallow. None of the other cases that I cite, none of the cases in the state's brief are, except for Westbecker, are factually similar, because the same exact thing happened to Mr. Westbecker. He pled guilty on 7 counts, got SISs on the whole batch. Then 2 years later, he comes back to court. They revoke his SIS probation, give him an SES probation, impose the 7 sentences. He comes back 2 years later, and then they impose sentence on 2 of the charges, but suspend probation on the 5. So he goes to DOC, does his time on the 2, comes back, gets the probation on the 5, and then after that, the probation on the 5 counts is revoked. He's delivered to DOC on the 5 counts alone, just as he was delivered earlier to DOC on the 2 counts alone. And the Court of Appeals decided that he had timely filed for relief on the 5 counts. We concede that Mr. Swallow is out of time to ask for post-conviction relief on the armed criminal action count.
The state argues that was 2 judgments as opposed to here we have 1 judgment.
I didn't exactly understand the court's argument because if you read Westbecker, it doesn't talk about single judgments, or they didn't decide the case based on single judgments at all. And with the same paperwork was involved in Mr. Swallow's case as it would have been in Mr. Westbecker's case, because when he appeared in front of the court initially and got the SES and the to-go sentence, then he would have gotten, there would have been 1 judgment form. And then when he came back to court later on and had that probation on the assault charge revoked, there was another judgment form. So I don't understand this single...
But there's still different times of delivery.
Yes, in both cases, you had 2 different delivery times. Yes, Judge, I'm sorry.
I assume that you think it's a good thing that trial judges should be able to suspend the imposition of sentences on some charges and not on others, so that even if somebody does serve a prison sentence, that the number of their convictions would be less if they successfully complete a concurrent term of parole and probation, right?
I guess that's
basically what happened in the Westbecker case. It recognized that was a possibility, even though it didn't work out because the guy ended up violating his probation. But had he not, he would have only had 2 convictions as opposed to 7.
Your Honor brings up a good point, because say Mr. Westbecker had completed his probation on the remaining 5 sentences, he could have never asked for post-conviction relief under Rule 24.035. Yeah, because he'd never been delivered.
You'll have time for rebuttal. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judge.
So let's get to this Westbecker case.
Yes, sir.
Now, I know it's a court of appeals, it doesn't bind us, but what is it? I mean, you could say it's 2 judgments, not 2 judgments. What is the difference between the 2?
Well, I mean, I think that is the difference. I agree that in Westbecker, the analysis did not involve whether there was a single judgment or 2 judgments. They didn't get into that. But as a factual matter, according to the language and the opinion, the Westbecker court noted that the circuit court had issued 2 separate judgments, 1 executing the 2 sentences, and suspending the execution of judgment on, or the execution of sentence, suspending the execution of the sentences on the other 5. And applying the text, the plain language, I think, of the rule, 24035 and 2915, of course, has parallel provisions, it appears, and this is what I argue in my brief and would like to argue today, that the sort of unit of inquiry is the judgment rather than the individual sentence. And the policy underpinnings of the post-conviction rules support that interpretation. And in one of the earliest arguments I had before this court, Judge Price remarked that an animating principle of the appellate procedures in this state are that we want to do things quickly and we want to do them once. And the rule that the state is advocating today, and that I believe is supported by the plain language of the post-conviction rules and the policies that underlie it, support that principle, that we do things quickly and we do them once. When Mr. Swallow was delivered to the Department of Corrections on the judgment, the criminal judgment against him, he had the opportunity to challenge the constitutionality of every conviction within that judgment.
And can you just school us a little bit on what you can appeal when? If you have an SIS, you cannot appeal that.
That's right. I mean, the law is, I'm sorry.
No, that's, and the SES, you can immediately appeal?
Right.
And obviously a fully implemented sentence you can appeal. What about an SES you appeal, but you haven't been delivered, so you could not file a post-conviction motion?
Actually, you can. Okay. And I think that that's one of the situations.
It's the time after your appeal.
Exactly. And that's one reason that I think the rule that the state is advocating makes so much sense, and the rule that Mr. Swallow asks for creates one of the anomalies that you mentioned. Under subpart B of 24035, and of course the parallel provision in 2915, if an appeal of the judgment or sentence sought to be vacated, set aside, or corrected was taken, then the timing requirement is 90 days after
the mandate.
Exactly.
Now, what about if you had SESs and SISs or sentences, and then you're going to have two judgments and two appeals. I'm just trying to clarify the foundation.
Of course.
Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
If you have SISs scattered in there, I think the law is fairly clear that's not a judgment of conviction. And
so you might have two judgments in that case and two different appeals and two different post-conviction hearings.
Okay. Yes, and that would apply, as you said, to both the appeal and any kind of post-conviction relief.
But the fact that there were some SISs wouldn't hold up your right to immediately appeal the other one.
Right, and I think that the appellate courts have basically treated an appeal where there are both executed sentences and SISs as just dismissing. I believe the dismiss is premature, any claim relating to the convictions. Well, they're not convictions,
the
SISs. And then go ahead and deal with, on appeal, the sentences that have been executed.
The usual JIS sentence and judgment form contemplates, though, that those will all be in one document, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, I think they are.
Which way do the trial judges usually do it? Do they do it like the judge in Westbecker and do two separate ones with the same case number? Or do they put them all on one and just check the boxes differently?
My impression is that typically they put them on a single form. And I think that, in fact, and as a matter of law, they are, well, I can't even say they're separate judgments because, I mean, as we've said, an SIS is not viewed as a final judgment. But it is a declaration separate from the judgment that is entered in that case. And then a court can refer back to the judgment form as it relates to the SIS if it needs to later on, if probation is violated or something along those lines.
If we don't accept your position, what are the consequences? That there could be two post-conviction proceedings.
Yes.
And the defendant wouldn't be able to relitigate in the second one because they would be a stop from doing that.
I would imagine that's true, unless they can identify some material difference in their claim, but I think this case is kind of a nice illustration of what would happen if an alternative rule is adopted. If this court adopts Mr. Swallow's rule, and then he would, and let's imagine that he had litigated the constitutionality of his armed criminal action conviction. He timely filed it, and he sought to challenge his assault conviction. According to his argument, even though the legal basis for arguing that his conviction is unconstitutional, I mean, that is that his counsel was ineffective for failing to pursue a motion to suppress, applies equally to the assault and to the armed criminal action. Under his rule, he had no right to challenge the assault because he hadn't been delivered to DOC on that sentence yet. He'd been delivered on the judgment, but not on that sentence, and therefore he has to wait. And unless and until he violates his probation, he will continue to serve.
And that's illogical, but on the other hand, he really hadn't been delivered on the underlying one, has he? So do we have to apply the rule as it's written?
We do have to apply the rule as it's written. And as it's written, subpart B says, and I'm skipping a few paragraphs, but if no appeal of such judgment was taken, the motion shall be filed within 180 days of the date the person is delivered to the custody of the Department of Corrections. In that subpart, the phrase or sentence, which appears throughout the rule, does not appear. Only judgment is referred to, and he was delivered on the judgment. It's a part of the judgment, but a sentence is a part of a judgment. He was delivered to the Department of Corrections on the judgment of conviction.
So, do you think Westbecker was decided correctly then?
Well, I think as a matter of fact, it was decided correctly. I don't know that the analysis was correct, no. I mean, in a way, I think the court sort of stumbled into the correct outcome because there happened to be two judgments.
So it's your position, if it's more than one judgment, then the delivery date can vary?
Yes. And, I mean, the delivery date can vary even within a judgment. And this case is an example. I mean, if one sentence is executed originally and another one is suspended,
Just because you call it a, the rules say you have to call it a judgment for it to be a judgment, but is the converse really true? I mean, just because you call something a judgment doesn't necessarily make it a judgment. Because the judgment and sentence form,
yes,
that grants that, if you get all SISs, it's still not a judgment. It says judgment and sentence at the top, but that doesn't make it a judgment.
Or that is true.
For that matter.
Yeah, that's right. It doesn't make it a judgment or a sentence.
It's basically an order. It's an order is what it is.
Right.
Well, but also the question is simply because the trial court said he was doing, Westbecker may not be correct because just because the trial court said it was to, it may not have in fact been to.
That's right. And I mean, the best we can rely on is the way the opinion was written, and it indicates that there were two judgments, but right, I mean.
Can you have two judgments in a single case, or is it your position each case only? I mean, could the judge here have separated it out and entered two totally separate judgments, even though it's the same case number?
I mean, I haven't seen that. I mean, we've got Westbecker, which indicated that there were two judgments. I think, as Judge Fisher pointed out, the practice is to have a single judgment, and then if there are SISs, those are not.
If you have counts you could sever, you decide to try them together, are you permitted to enter separate judgments on them, or there's just nothing that you know addresses the permissibility?
Well, I mean, a severance is permitted, but I think not.
And then it would obviously be separate. But
right.
Well, your opponent makes the argument that you can have a case where there was a mistrial only on one count and a conviction mm-hmm. on another.
Mm-hmm.
And so you would not hold up your appeal of the conviction on one count. So under that circumstance, do you have two judgments?
Well, if there's an appeal, you may. I mean, if there's an appeal that proceeds, I think
you would be entitled to appeal that one conviction.
Sure. I mean, the very existence of appeal, I think, presumes that there's a judgment, because the appellate courts will not entertain an appeal where there's no judgment. And the post-conviction rules, I think, follow from that. The availability of post-conviction relief presumes largely that an appeal has at least been available. Of course, in a guilty plea, the grounds for which you can appeal are limited. But the post-conviction rules come into play after a defendant has had the opportunity to appeal.
Are there, under the circumstances of this case,
yes, ma'am,
could there be claims of error that would not have arisen at the time of being delivered on one conviction or on one count, and that a defendant ought to be able to raise at the time of delivery to the Department of Correction on when an SCS is executed?
I can't think of any. And again, this case presents a good example. One of the substantive claims that he raises or attempts to raise is a complaint about the effectiveness of counsel at probation revocation hearing. I mean, the appellate courts have already decided that those claims are non-cognizable.
They're cognizable by writ, but not as part.
Exactly. Not cognizable in a post-conviction motion, because a post-conviction motion is directed at the constitutionality or legality or jurisdiction of the sentence itself. And so if these claims, or in the conviction itself, so if the claims that are the subject of a post-conviction motion arise from the judgment, then there shouldn't be any cognizable claims that arise afterward. And it makes sense. And, you know, Mr. Swallow and his attorney, they're arguing on the rule that would be of most benefit to him, which makes perfect sense. But the rule that the state is advocating, I think in general, will be a benefit to defendants because it will permit them to raise every claim that arises out of a single judgment at the first instance. And this gets back to the principle that Judge Price
elicited. Now, it may be rare, but I do remember there was a case, the defendant's name was Reynolds, where the defendant confessed in a plea, and they found a real murderer at a later time, and then they said, well, you're not guilty if you found the real murderer and knew where the bodies were at a later time. And the fellow was one of these situations where he's in the police thing. He's not very he's not very astute as what's going on, and he just confesses, and he doesn't know what he's doing. But later on, they found that the real murderer was somewhere else who confessed later.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be something out of the expanse of time might be a situation where it might benefit the defendant. Maybe rare, but occasionally that might happen.
Sure. And in circumstances of newly discovered evidence, I think that this court has already held that evidence can be raised in direct appeal if that's still pending. In fact, I know the court's held that. And the court has also identified, habeas, that sort of evidence can come in other proceedings. And the state wouldn't try and stop
that. All this post-conviction stuff is to avoid habeas, but still.
Sure.
Habeas could be filed.
Yeah, and if newly discovered evidence arises when the post-conviction motion is pending, then perhaps a defendant can file a motion and have a hearing on that. And that might be a different case. But I don't think that the fact that he'd already been delivered on a portion of his judgment would really affect that analysis. It's the discovery of newly discovered evidence that would make the difference there. And again, appellant said that this is a rare situation, and that may be true, but Missouri has a handful of statutes. Armed criminal action is a prime example, but also child enticement, that have sort of hard floors on sentences where the courts are required to send somebody.
This is maybe a little bit out. The problem, one of the reasons maybe they want to withdraw it is life in prison in Missouri is, if it's not LWOP, it's, what is it, like 16 or 17 years, and then you're available for parole?
Sure.
So it could be less than the 40 years of Kansas, so he might want to try to take his chances and win on the in Missouri with the outside chance to get life, but it's not the same as 40 years.
Sure, I can see why he would want to try to take his chances, perhaps. That's not necessarily irrational, but he would have that opportunity immediately after he was sentenced to the 20 years. Now, the execution of the sentence was suspended, so it may be that he thought, well, I can do the probation and outlast it. But he had the opportunity to challenge the constitutionality of that conviction at the first instance when he was delivered on the armed criminal action. And, I mean, this situation is no different than someone who was not initially delivered to the Department of
Corrections. If he wanted to appeal that, did he have to appeal it right then?
Yes. Yes. I mean, I think that he had to appeal the entire judgment. And
of course, Judge Cook is a very fine judge. Basically, he was saying he has the right to, he knows what the deal is, and he's bargaining to get the best deal for himself. So it was in the plea bargain, he had the benefit of the bargain.
Although he doubled the recommendation.
Right. So. Right. No, he did. And I don't know what he was thinking. I mean, the victim's father presented moving testimony. I mean, this was a brutal crime. So the judge may have been moved by that. But the defendant in this case had a full opportunity to file a post-conviction motion when he was delivered to DOC on the judgment. He chose not to do so, and therefore the time expired.
Would if he had filed it immediately on the whole judgment, including the SES, would it have been, would the state have argued it was premature, or could the state argue it was premature as to the SES?
I think if the state had argued that, it would have been wrong. And I mean, I assume that clarifying that rule is one of the reasons that this court took transfer of this case. I mean, probably if Mr. Swallow had timely filed a post-conviction motion challenging the ACA and the assault, the state probably would have argued that the assault thing is premature. The defense would have said, no, it's not. He's challenged the judgment.
Why would they have argued that? I mean, I thought it's absolutely clear that you only have one judgment and you have to do everything then.
I believe that is true. We would have been wrong. I mean, it's an adversarial proceeding, and that's the way this works. But, I mean, honestly, I think
the state carefully chooses which cases to
Mr. Buchheim would have been
argue.
Wrong. You wouldn't have made it.
That's right. Mr. Buchheim would have taken this one. And I would be up here advocating for justice and correct. Thank you very much.
Now, I thought the insurance case was confusing, but now I've learned more. You folks have been very helpful trying to clarify this.
May I remind the court that Rule 24.035 is this court's rule?
Well,
go to the show. Nobody can write a good rule.
First of all,
does that mean we can interpret it however we want?
That means you can also rewrite it however you wish as well.
I just wanted to try to make clear what you were trying to tell us.
As Jackie Brown said in Some Like It Hot, no one's perfect.
Judge Breckenridge, you were asking, like, were there issues on that Mr. Swallow would not have been able to raise the first time, but the second time? The answer is a very definite yes.
And give us an example.
Yes. Under Griffin versus State, counsel can be held ineffective, and I'm sorry I don't have the cite for that offhand, but counsel can be held ineffective after probation has been revoked for failing to advocate at sentencing. It is a separate issue from counsel's assistance.
That would be an SIS, not an SES.
No, that would be after, any time after a probation is revoked. Because after a probation is revoked, the court still has the decision, okay, now that we've decided the probation was violated, now what do we do?
Well, but if it's an SES, you've already decided what sentence to impose.
Well, the court could have put Mr. Swallow in 559 or 217 or could have continued him on the probation. Just the fact that his probation was revoked is not the end of the discussion.
Yeah, but you can only appeal an improper revocation of probation. You can't appeal it. You have to have it reviewed by writ. That's not something you bring up the revocation of probation issue, which I see is what you're raising here. They could have gotten assistance on is reviewable by writ, not through the PCR.
Your Honor, I'm not talking about whether or not the probation gets revoked. That's not the end of the discussion. Mm-hmm. The court still has to decide, having decided that a probation or violated probation, okay, now what do we do? And that's when counsel's job is not over at that point. Counsel still has to advocate for his client, bringing in witnesses, making arguments, bringing in records. So the job is not over once the court says, okay, the probation has been violated. So,
what
yes, there were.
Of Griffin? Is it Griffin or Griffin?
Griffin.
What
versus
was the facts there? Was it an SES or an SIS?
After Griffin, I do not remember, Judge.
Well, in Griffin, the reason those issues were able to be raised was because there had never been a delivery. Whether it was an SES or SIS didn't matter. The defendant had never been delivered to custody. He had been granted probation. And then wasn't that the allegation that they failed to call a particular witness or something like that?
They failed to add the counsel's failure to call witnesses at the sentencing hearing, yes.
That the defendant claim would have been favorable or maybe talk the judge into granting further probation or something.
Right. So he would not have been able to raise that issue about counsel's advocacy at sentencing when he was first delivered on the ACA, because he never got probation. There was never a probation hearing to have. There was a separate sentencing proceeding with separate counsel. I think it was a different counsel at the second sentencing.
Griffin wasn't a split case, though, right?
No, it was not.
Griffin was a straight case where the sentencing was just deferred because the guy got probation, so he'd never been delivered.
Your Honor is correct. Yes.
If there's no other questions, the case will be taken under submission, and the court will stand in recess.
Your Honor, may I make one remark?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. There was something that the state had said in its argument that really bothered me. The fact that how the state's position would be better for criminal defendants. And that bothers me, frankly. Because, you know, we're all talking here about Rule 24.035, and I've enjoyed it immensely. And it's very
fun. We have, too.
Thank you. But this is not an academic issue for Mr. Swallow. This is whether he gets to have a case at all. And please don't forget that when in your discussions. I appreciate that. Thank you.
I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Case will be taken under submission. Thank you for the arguments.